Chapter 3. Janice hadn't changed. She still looked as beautiful as ever. Her honey blonde hair was worn long and loose to her shoulders, and her exquisite long legs were encased in tight jeans, the outfit completed with boots and a simple white blouse over which she wore a brown tweed sport jacket. Even in such casual, comfortable clothes, and despite the redness of her eyes from tears, she looked absolutely stunning, and still could not help being struck by the same old feelings. There had always been an extremely strong chemistry between them, a powerful sexual attraction that they both had felt from the moment of their first meeting when Shelley Taylor had introduced them. They slept together that first night, and Steele had fallen head over heels in love with her, but for Janice, it was never quite that simple. Steele was a cop on the strike force, and Janice didn't want anything to do with cops. Shelley's brother, Mick, was a strike force cop, and Janice had never gotten along with him very well. She detested what she saw as their swaggering braggadocio, their cock-of-the-walk demeanor, and their us-versus-them attitude. She hated having to listen to their war stories. The world they lived in was a savage, violent world that she didn't want to be exposed to. Steele wasn't like that. He didn't swagger as if he were some sort of modern gladiator. In social situations, he didn't dwell upon his exploits. He was soft-spoken and considerate, with a quiet strength about him that had appealed to her strongly. She was dismayed to find herself so powerfully attracted to him. From the very first, she wanted him, and she knew he wanted her. It was like a hammer blow between the eyes. Pow! Chemistry. She had gone to bed with him, but she was determined that it remain only a casual relationship. The last thing she wanted was to become seriously involved with a cop. In the kind of world they lived in, you never knew from one day to the next if he'd be coming home or if he'd be lying there bleeding on a street somewhere. Janice didn't want that for herself. She didn't want that awful job coming home to her each night. But with the powerful attraction that they felt for one another, it was doomed not to remain a casual thing. Steele was serious right from the start. While she ran hot and cold. When he wasn't there, she kept telling herself she'd break it off. But when they were together, her desire for him overcame everything else, and she just felt herself getting in deeper and deeper. When he proposed, her mind screams no, but she said yes. And that ambivalence always remained to contaminate their marriage. She wanted Steele the man, but she didn't want anything to do with Steele the cop. The trouble was, it was impossible to separate the two. Within a year, they had started to drift apart. Things got better for a while after Jason was born, with their new child occupying all their attention while they were home together. But it wasn't long before the downslide started once again. There was another respite with the birth of Corey, but children have never been enough to salvage a shaky marriage. And soon, all the old tensions returned. In the bedroom, everything was great between them. Sexually, it was as if they were two precision-tooled parts of the same machine. But in ordinary, day-to-day life, they couldn't seem to get along. Janice was never able to accept Steele's job, to accept the fact that it was more than just a job. It was a part and parcel of what he was and who he was, and she wound up resenting him. They stayed together for almost 20 years, largely because of the children and because Steele was a Roman Catholic and a man who was very serious about the idea of commitment. But with every passing year, they became more and more distant. She felt trapped. They argued frequently, with Janice usually taking the slightest excuse to initiate a fight, and then they would make up in the bedroom, and she would apologize for being such a bitch, and promised that things would get better, but they never got better. They only got worse. Steele later discovered that at some point she had started cheating on him with a succession of lovers. She didn't know he knew, and he had never wanted to find out the details, though Higgins had offered to supply them. For a long time, he blamed himself for not being able to fulfill her needs, or even understand them, and he had only lately come to understand that, though perhaps he was not entirely innocent of blaming their disintegrating marriage. Their disintegrating marriage, a large part of the responsibility for the failure of their marriage lay with Janice, who had... Wow. A large part of the responsibility for the failure of their relationship lay with Janice, who had listened to her crotch when it said yes, and ignored her mind when it said no. Jesus. After he was ambushed by Borodini's soldiers and reconstructed as a cyborg, Janice had divorced him. She hadn't even bothered to wait to tell him to his face. It was all taken care of neatly and cleanly while he was still undergoing the long series of operations. And when he came online, the divorce was a fait accompli. Janice even left the city, leaving no forwarding address, and she had taken out a restraining order against him that prevented him from trying to see or contact her and the children. It was a restraining order that he could not contest because the courts weren't anxious to decide the question of whether or not a computer had any civil rights. In her own words, she didn't want Jason and Corey to have some kind of robot for a father. He had not seen or heard from her or the children since, and now she was here, in his apartment, appearing out of nowhere, her eyes reddened with tears. The only reason Steele could think of for her coming back like this was that something had gone very badly wrong. He felt a knot forming in his stomach. He hoped the children were okay. "Hello, Janice!" She looked up at him and managed a weak smile. Raven diplomatically left them alone together.
"Hello, Steele."
"You look good!" He didn't know what else to say.
"So do you,"
she said, somewhat uncertainly. She had the look he'd seen so many times before, when people found out what he was and stared at him with apprehension, with uncertainty, like looking at some alien creature, trying to discern a sign of the inhuman in the very human-looking man who stood before them. "You mean I don't look like a robot? Is that it? He said, regretting at the moment he said it, but he couldn't help himself. It had always been that way with them. Too much history, too many years of pressure and frustration. They could never keep from sniping at each other, from sticking in the knife and giving it a little twist.
"I didn't say that,"
she said. "You didn't have to, but then you never really said anything, did you? You just decided to cut and run. You never even gave me a chance to say goodbye to the kids. You didn't even stick around long enough to say goodbye yourself. Is that all our relationship was worth?"
"I notice you didn't waste much time in finding yourself another one,"
she said.
"She's very young, isn't she? Not what I would have thought is your type. Where on earth did you find her? She looks like a hooker, for God's sake."
"Maybe that's because she was a hooker," Steele said. She stared at him. Or, as this says, she starred at him.
"You're kidding."
"No, but the operative word is was."
"You surprise me,"
she said.
"I wouldn't have thought that you could sink so low."
"It's not your place to judge either me or Raven," Steele said tensely, determined to hold his temper in check. "At least since she's been with me, she hasn't slept around, which is a lot more than I could say for you." She grimaced.
"So you knew. What did you do? Hire a detective?"
Steele sighed. "Forget it, Janice. All that's ancient history. It doesn't matter now. What matters is the present. What are you doing here? What do you want? Is it the kids? Is something wrong?" She nodded and started to cry again. "What is it?" he said, concerned.
"It's Corey,"
she said, blinking back tears.
"She's run away from home, and I don't know where Jason is. He's gone to look for her. We had a fight, an awful fight. I thought they might be with you."
"I haven't seen them," Steele said with concern.
"Would you tell me if you had?"
"What are you saying, Janice? You think I'd try to take them from you?"
"The thought had occurred to me."
Steele shook his head. "After all those years, I thought you knew me better than that."
"I don't know you now,"
she said defensively.
I just don't know you anymore, Steele. I don't know who you are, or even what you are."
He let that pass. There was no point in arguing with her. No point in trying to convince her of anything. "Did you go to the police?"
"Yes, I filed a missing persons report. But they told me there really wasn't much else they could do. There's so many runaways. I told them about you. They said they would investigate, but..."
"I haven't heard anything yet. What police department was it?" She hesitated. "Come on, Janice, for God's sake. If I wanted to, I could have found out where you lived at any time in less than 5 minutes, just by picking up a phone."
"Boston,"
she said. "What made you think Corey might have come here?" he said.
"She left a note, said something about going home. I thought she meant you."
"I haven't seen or heard from Corey and Jason since you took them away," he said. She broke down and started sobbing. Steele put his arms around her as she sobbed into his chest. "Okay, okay," he said. "Try to calm down. Tell me what happened."
I told them you were dead,"
she said, looking away guiltily.
"You've been killed, all right? It was a stupid thing to do, I know, but at the time, I mean, I had to tell them something. I couldn't tell them that their father had become a..."
Her voice trailed off. "A machine," said Steele.
They were children,
she said.
How the hell do you explain something like that to children?
You tell them the truth, he said. They're teenagers. They're certainly old enough to understand about a thing like divorce. I think they might have understood the rest of it as well if you only gave them half a chance. You had no right doing what you did, Janice. Regardless of what you think of me, regardless of what you think I am, I'm still their father. If nothing else, they had a right to know the truth. Did you really think they wouldn't find out?
I don't know what I thought,
she said miserably.
I was confused. I was frightened. I was...
All right, never mind all that. Go on.
They found out about you. I couldn't keep it from them. It was all over the news, on television. We had a terrible fight. They said awful things to me. Horrible things.
Can you really blame them?
Damn you, Steele. I was only trying to do what I thought was best for them.
No, you weren't. You were trying to do what you thought was best for you. All right, forget it. I'm sorry I said that. The important thing now is to find them. When did Corey run away?
5 days ago. And Jason the day after. I was sure they were with you, and I thought the police would come and get them and bring them back. And I just couldn't bring myself to call you, and I waited as long as I could, but I didn't hear anything.
Jesus Christ, said Steele.
Where are they, Steele? Tell me. You've got no right to keep my children from me.
I haven't got them, Janice. I don't have the faintest idea where they are. This is the first I've heard of this. I swear to you.
I don't believe you. You're lying.
I don't know where they are, Janice, but I promise you, I'll do everything I can to find them.
You mean you really haven't got them? Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Take it easy. I'll get the police here working on it right away. I'll put word out on the streets, and I'll have someone call Boston and see if they can light a fire under them, just in case they haven't left the city. Meanwhile, the best thing you can do is to go home. There's nothing you can do here. Go back to Boston, and as soon as I hear anything, I'll let you know.
You promise?
I promise. Look, for all we know, they might even come back on their own. You certainly won't be doing them any good here.
I suppose you're right. I've just been frantic. I thought if anything happens to them.
I'll find them, Janice. I promise you, I'll find them. Now go home and let me get to work on it. And if they come back, let me know at once. Don't worry, I won't try to interfere. Your restraining order is still in effect.
She looked up at him, her eyes brimming with tears.
I'm sorry,
she said.
It's just that I...
She shook her head.
Can't you try to understand?
I can try, but that is important now. The important thing is to find Corey and Jason and make sure they're all right.
She looked down at the floor and nodded. He walked her to the door. Then he turned to see Raven standing in the doorway of their bedroom.
I heard,
she said.
Are you all right?
No, he said softly. No, I'm not all right. I've got to find a psychopathic cyborg who's loose somewhere in the city. A man who used to be my partner and my friend. And now my kids are out there somewhere too. And I promised her I'd find them. But they don't show up here. I really don't know what I can do.
There's some people I can talk to,
she said.
And Ice can help. We can put the word out. Find out if anybody's seen them. It's a long shot, but you never know. Chances are they might have even show up here. Have you got any pictures of them?
Steele nodded.
Yeah, I'll get some copies made when I file a report down at Strike Force headquarters. I've got to go down there anyway and take charge of the stalker operation.
He sighed heavily.
I've got to go put together a manhunt to find my best friend and kill him.
Officer Manny Esteban and his partner, Sergeant Harry Crane, were cruising in their radio motor patrol car near the edge of Midtown on West 34th Street when a man stepped out onto the street right in front of them. Crane had to slam on the brakes just to keep from hitting him. Jesus fucking Christ, he swore. Did you see that stupid son of a bitch almost got himself? He didn't get any further. The man bent over, grasped the bumper of their vehicle, and, to their utter disbelief, lifted the front wheels up right into the air. But before they could react, he threw the patrol car over on its side. The roof buckled as it rolled over, crushing the lights and siren.
Holy shit!
Cried Crane as they were thrown out of their seats and against each other. He awkwardly clawed for his holster, but before he could get the gun out, their attacker ripped the driver's side door off its hinges and threw it into the street behind him. He reached in, grabbed Crane, and dragged him out. As Esteban struggled to open the door and get out on his side, Stalker lifted Crane up into the air as if he were a doll, swung him around, and smashed his head against the upturned car with brutal force, snapping his neck and breaking his skull open like an egg.
Esteban finally got the door open and scrambled out of his side of the car. He rolled to his feet and pulled his gun out. He fired across the exposed undercarriage of the car three times. All three bullets struck Stalker squarely in the chest, and they didn't even slow him down. Gaping in astonishment, Esteban squeezed off another three shots as the assailant came around the car, heading for him. Esteban kept firing until he emptied the whole clip, with no apparent effect. Several of the shots struck the cop killer in the head, but aside from having his neck snapped back briefly by the impact of the 9mm hollow points, the bullets seemed completely ineffective. Stalker reached out and plucked the gun from Esteban's grasp. He squeezed it in his right hand and crushed it. Solid steel. Crumpled it as if it was nothing more than paper. He tossed it aside and grabbed Esteban by the shoulders. Esteban screamed as the powerful hands squeezed, and there was a sharp cracking sound as the bones in his upper arms splintered. He felt himself being bent back against the upturned car, his spine strained to the breaking point as his assailant brought his face up close to his.
"I want steel,"
he said hoarsely.
"You understand? You hear me?"
Esteban cried out in agony.
"It's his fault they did this to me,"
Stalker said.
"It's his fault. I'm going to make him pay. I'm going to kill him for what he has made them do to me. Him and every goddamn cop in this lousy motherfucking city. Every one of them is going to pay. Every single one."
Esteban was abruptly released. He sank down to the street, unable to support himself with his arms. He waited for the killing blow, but it didn't come. When he looked up, Stalker was gone. Whimpering with pain, his arms hanging limp and useless at his sides, Esteban crawled like a worm back inside the overturned patrol car. He tried not to look at his partner's corpse lying in the street, its head broken open like a melon. Using his teeth, he managed to get the headset off its hook and radio a call for help. Jacob Hardesty was a big, ham-fisted, gravel-voiced bull of a man, the chief of the NYPD Special Operations Division, more commonly known as the Strike Force. He and Steele went back together a long way. He had been Steele's training officer when Steele was just a rookie, and later on he had been Steele's sergeant. When Steele made sergeant, Jake Hard-Ass Hardesty was his lieutenant, and now he was the chief, getting old and heavy behind his massive, burn-scarred and coffee-stained desk, a good street cop stuck in the bureaucratic limbo between the commissioners and mayor's offices and the men under his command. And if he didn't have enough trouble, now he'd have to come clean up a mess made by the feds and somehow manage to do it without telling the media a thing. "I just got off the phone with your man Higgins when the call came in," he said to Steele. "We've got two officers down, one dead, one seriously wounded. According to the surviving officer, Patrolman Esteban, Stalker stepped out in front of their RMP and flipped over like it was a toy. Then he ripped off the door, pulled out Sergeant Crane, and bashed his brains out. Esteban and he emptied an entire clip into him, chest and head, and Stalker just kept right on coming. He disarmed Esteban and pulverized the bones in both his shoulders. And while he was at it, he mentioned your name." "My name?" Steele said. "Yeah," said Hardesty. "Esteban was in shock, but he was very definite on that point. Apparently, Stalker seems to feel that you're responsible for what's happened to him, and he intends to kill you. You and every other police officer in the city." "Christ," said Steele. "Stopping him is going to be a problem in itself," said Hardesty. "What I'd like to know is how the hell am I supposed to do it and keep the media from finding out about it? Higgins seemed to think that..." "Screw Higgins," Steele said. "Higgins put me in charge of this operation. If the media starts bugging you for a statement, then give them one. Tell them the whole story. And if Higgins gives you any shit about it, refer him straight to me." "You sure about this?" Hardesty said. "Higgins seemed determined to keep this whole thing under wraps. If I blow the story and then tell him I had your authorization, it'll all come down on you." "So," said Steele, "what are they going to do? Pull my plug? They need me, Jake. Right now, I'm all they've got. Hell, all Higgins is interested in doing is covering his ass. Only, I'm not going to let him do that at the expense of the people of this city. Besides, I don't see how he can. This whole thing is going to blow up right in his face. I'd rather the people had the right information up front than fuel media speculation with all sorts of stupid denials. Then we're going to have enough trouble on our hands." "Which brings us back to the main problem," Hardesty said. "How are we going to stop this guy? If I understood correctly, he's got everything you've got and then some. We haven't even got a proper make on him yet. Esteban gave us a description, but there's been no time to get a composite sketch made up."
You can do better than that, said Steele. You got his photograph.
We do,
said Hardesty. He used to be a Strike Force cop, said Steele. Pull your files on Mick Taylor. Hardesty's jaw dropped open.
Mick Taylor,
he said with disbelief.
But I thought he was dead. I went to his funeral, for Christ's sake.
You didn't see a body, did you?
No, there was no body. They said he'd been...
They lied, said Steele. They lied to Shelley, they lied to me, they lied to you and all Mick's friends. They've had Mick on ice ever since we were ambushed together in Harlem. They kept him on life support until they got their funding to build themselves another cyborg. I worked out so well, the finance committee okayed their new budget, and they went ahead and with a brand new and improved model designated Stalker, a prototype for a new generation police and military cyborg. Superior construction, laser and plasma weapon systems, and I don't know what the hell else. It seems the engineers threw in a whole bunch of improvements just to show off what they could do given enough money. Only now, no one can tell what they did because they're all dead, and Stalker smashed their databanks when he ran amok in their lab complex.
Jesus,
Hardesty said, letting his breath out in a heavy sigh.
Laser and plasma cannon systems!
He shook his head.
I'm not even sure I want to know what else he may have. And on top of that, it's Mick. And if things aren't bad enough, Mick Taylor has a lot of friends in this apartment.
I know, Jake. He was my partner, Steele said. He walked over to the window in Hardesty's office and stared out through the grimy glass. But that's not Mick Taylor out there, he said quietly. Maybe it was Mick once, but not anymore. I don't know what they did to him. Maybe something went wrong in his cybernetic brain. Maybe the software was bad. Hell, I don't know. But whatever it was, Mick Taylor's gone now. What we've got out there is some kind of Frankenstein's monster. A criminally insane computer brain and a superhuman body. And the kindest thing we could do to it is put it out of its misery. He turned to look at Hardesty. It's what I'd want for myself if it ever happened to me.
Hardesty met his gaze. And to his credit, he didn't look away when he asked,
You think there's any chance of that?
Steele compressed his lips in a tight grimace. I honestly don't know, Jake. He shook his head and sighed.
No, that's a cop-out. There's a chance it happened to him, so I guess that it means it could happen to me, too. And if it did, I'd want the job done quickly and efficiently. We all make at least that much. Okay, said Hardesty. How do you want to play it?
We'll issue a citywide on all points, said Steele.
All units, have all the watch commanders pass out photos of Mick with strict instructions that if any RMP encounters him, they are to avoid contact at all costs and immediately get on the horn to the strike force. Stress that. We don't want any heroes, Jake. Look what happened to Esteban and Crane. Regular RMP units just don't have the ordnance to deal with Stalker. If he tries to engage any of them, their orders are to run.
Run, said Hardesty.
That's right, said Steele. Run like hell, or Stalker will take them apart. We're going to need well-trained Strike Force personnel and some serious ordnance to take him out. Higgins is going to have several squads of federal troops standing by to back us up. So we'll have to send up a comm link between our people on the streets, headquarters, and the federal building. We'll organize the entire division into flying squads, each man equipped with full riot gear, magazines loaded with high-explosive and armor-piercing IMO. The shields will work by standard duty rotation, with the federal squads on standby. That way, we can have people out covering the city as much as possible, with the feds in reserve for a fast chopper drop the minute we get contact. We'll need as many choppers in the air as we can spare, both scouting for Stalker and ready to pick up and transport squads across the city at a moment's notice. Higgins can loan us a few choppers as well.
You want one for yourself?
I've already requisitioned one from the agency. A small X-Wing. They're faster.
Okay, said Hardesty.
Anything else?
Steele paused.
Yeah, he said. One more thing. Something personal. I just saw Janice.
Janice?
Hardesty said, surprised.
She's back in town?
Then he frowned.
What's wrong?
The kids are missing, Steele said. Corey ran away from home and Jason apparently took off to look for her.
Oh, hell,
said Hardesty.
Janice thought they might have come down here to see me, but there's been no sign of them. She filed a report in Boston. That's where they're living now. But it seems they haven't really done anything about it. You know how it is with runaways. They're not high a priority. I thought maybe you could do me a favor and give the Boston PD a call. Ask them to do a little extra trouble. And circulate some photos of the kids around for our department, just in case. I brought some along.
Of course,
said Hardesty, reaching for the photos.
I'll get these duped and put the word out immediately. Let people know it's family.
Thanks, Jake. I appreciate it.
Don't mention it. It's a hell of a time for something like this, ain't it?
Yeah,
said Steele with a tight grimace.
Maybe they'll show up at your place.
I hope so, Jake, said Steele. I sure as hell hope so.
They lived down in the subway tunnels. It was dark and comforting down there, like a vast womb of steel and concrete. A few of the tunnels where several trains still ran beneath the streets of Midtown were illuminated every few yards by work lights, but they generally avoided those. They kept to the tunnels that were abandoned, falling into disrepair, plunged into Stygian darkness. It was cold and damp in the tunnels, but in the winter, it was warmer than the streets above and safer than the abandoned, crumbling ruins that dotted no man's land. There they would have to worry about the gangs that controlled their turf with an iron hand. The gangs would have taken a dim view of predators like them. Here, down in the tunnels, they could hide and hunt. Many of them no longer remembered what their names were. They had become mere shadows of human beings, wraith-like entities that shambled through the underground tunnels like specters. They dressed in layers of smelly rags and cast off clothes, whatever they could find, or take from their victims. Their hair was long, matted, and scraggly, falling to their shoulders like Spanish moss. Their faces were gaunt and craggy, deeply etched with lines that were filled in with dirt and grime. Their eyes were deeply sunken, their vision preternaturally acute in almost total darkness. They looked emaciated, but their appearance was deceptive. They were far from harmless, and the women were just as savage as the men. They looked just like what they were, ghouls, cadaverous feasters of human flesh. It was only fitting that they live underground. They hunted together like packs of starving wolves, lurking near the gateways to the surface in anticipation of unwary and uncautious prey. Work crews tried to keep the old subway tunnels sealed, but it was a losing battle. The tunnel dwellers always broke through once again or found other ways up out of their warren. From time to time, the Strike Force cops descended into the tunnels and had attempts to clean them out, but it was a task akin to trying to eradicate the city's rats and roaches. There were always more of them, and there were too many places where they could hide from the exterminators. Often, driven by madness and starvation, they fought amongst themselves like rabid dogs and ate the flesh of those they killed. Unlike the raving screamers, they were not totally devoid of reason, though many of them were mentally deranged. Not a few were sane, if killing and eating their own kind could, by any stretch of the imagination, possibly be considered sane. But in a world such as the one they lived in, normal definitions did not often apply. Normality did not apply. It would be easier to, it would be closer to the truth to say that they were rational as opposed to sane. They knew full well what they were doing. Unlike some of the more disturbed among them, most of them were fully intact with and in touch with reality. They found ways to rationalize what they had become. They blamed circumstances and society. They told themselves and one another that they had no choice, that they were driven to hunt and consume their own kind by a desperate imperative of the survival, because the world above cared nothing for them. And in that, at least, they were not entirely wrong. A group of them was sitting around a fire they had built on the rusted tracks where two tunnels intersected. They huddled close to the flames, their faces illuminated in the flickering firelight with the faces of the lost, visions from some surrealistic painting by Doré or Bosch. Their faces of the damned, some of their eyes were empty, staring vacantly into the dancing flames. Others glinted with the lights of madness. It had been a long time since they had eaten. And at such times, the group dynamic became a very tenuous thing. The tension was palpable amongst them. They were hungry, they were tired, and each of them was wondering who would be the first to fall asleep. The sound of approaching footsteps galvanized them. Like animals, their ears picked up. They listened. There was only one pair of footsteps, one individual approaching. They exchanged quick glances and hungry glances. Not a threat, a victim. Or so they thought. As the footsteps drew nearer, echoing throughout the tunnel, they scuttled back into the shadows, away from the firelight. They drew back into the niches in the tunnels and put there so the track workmen could get back out of the way of passing subway trains. They waited, fingering their weapons, carving knives and fire axes, clubs with nails driven into them, sharpened sticks of wood, iron pipes, steel concrete reinforcing rods, whatever they could find and use to kill their prey. The footsteps stopped. The dark figure of a man stood just beyond the firelight, in the center of the tunnel. Perhaps he had been attracted by the fire's warmth. Perhaps he'd been too afraid to risk coming any closer. No matter. If he fled, they'd run him down. He was a big man, but they'd bring him down by the sheer weight of their numbers. And his size meant that there would be enough to go around for all of them to have their fill. He simply stood there, waiting. They licked their lips in hungry anticipation. Why didn't he come closer? Why didn't he run? Why didn't he do something? They weren't aware that he knew exactly where they were. They didn't know that he could hear them breathing, that with his cybernetically enhanced senses, he could even hear their hearts beating. They could see even better than they could in the dark. He could wait no longer. They stepped out of their hiding places, holding their makeshift weapons in their hands. More of them came out. Slowly, they approached him, watching, waiting for him to bolt in fear. Only he didn't bolt. He simply stood there, watching them, and waiting. A few of them were almost within reach of him. Why didn't he run? Perhaps his mind was too far gone. They hesitated. What if he was a screamer? But no, screamers didn't act that way. Screamers were like howling beasts, wailing themselves hoarse and crawling at their agonizing wounds. Their minds completely gone, attacking anything that moved. Like the predatory creatures that they were, the tunnel dwellers tried to sense his fear, the emotion that would galvanize them into action. But there was something wrong. They could not tell what it was. This man was not afraid. Somehow, they knew this man was dangerous. Slowly, they drew closer, moving around the fire on either side. And then, just as they were about to spring, the quarry's eyes suddenly lit up with two bright, glowing pinpoints of red light. They froze, eyes wide, mouths open, staring at the large, shadowy figure with the hellfire in his eyes. He raised his arm, and white heat stretched from seemed to belch forth from his outstretched fingers. The plasma burst and struck the fire behind them, and blossomed into a huge tower of flame, shooting sparks and burning cinders throughout the tunnel. As they cried out and started to fall back in terror, Stalker fired again, the plasma flame blocking their escape.
"Freeze,"
he said.
"Stand where you are, or burn."
There was nowhere to run. They stood before him, helpless, quaking in fear. Several of them soiled themselves.
"Follow me, and I'll get you food and weapons,"
he said.
"Guns and ammunition. Do as I say, and I'll let you live."
"Who? Who are you?"
one of them said in a trembling voice.
"What are you?"
"Your death,"
he said.
"All your life. The choice is yours. It doesn't matter to me one way or the other. So what's it going to be?"
They stood there terrified, instinctively huddling closer to one another.
You said you could get us food," said one of them. "Meat? Fresh meat?"
"And weapons,"
he said.
"Guns. Enough for all of you. Only if you try to use them against me, I'll kill you. Like this."
He raised his other arm and a bright beam of collimated laser light suddenly lanced out from it, striking one of the tunnel dwellers right between the eyes. He cried out briefly and crumpled to the ground.
Don't kill us, please. We'll do anything you say. Anything."
Stalker smiled.
"I thought you would."
End of chapter.